First of all, are we all ready? First, welcome to week two. It's very inspiring to see everyone's dedication to arrive here even in this weather. Although having said that, I thought maybe we're used to it. Like after last week, this is like spring, you know, this is like mild weather. No, but that's they say rain is a sign of blessing, so let's hope we're destined for lots of blessing. Before we start today, just a quick word. First of all, a thank you to all those that have already participated in our annual raffle. You'll notice that we have this, I don't know what you call it, this thing at the back. This year we've called the raffle a 613 challenge, corresponding to the 613 commandments in the Torah. Idea is we want to try and reach a little bit more than last year and try to sell 613 tickets. And what we've done is we've identified different stops along the way which corresponding to different mitzvot, and those people who happen to buy the raffle that are on those numbers, the next one is I think 180, get an extra raffle ticket. That's how we've done it this year, you've seen the emails. So if you can spread the word and inspire and motivate as many people as possible to try and reach the 613 challenge, that would be great. We're going to go for about another month, and we've made a pretty good start, as you can see, and hopefully we'll be climbing up quickly. Okay, so we started last week to deal with the topic of difficult conversations. I want to just spend a couple of minutes just reviewing what we did last week. Last week, we first of all asked the question, what is a difficult conversation? And we said that a difficult conversation is anything that's hard to talk about. And we divided it into three different categories. It's up there on the board, the three different categories. We said the first type of conversation is confrontation. When you're in the middle of a conflict, someone's screaming at you, there's a dispute going on, there's confrontation going on, we need to have a conversation to try and resolve or diffuse it. We're afraid of the consequences, we're afraid to have the conversation, but that's one type of difficult conversation. The other one is just one that's difficult because you are afraid that it could lead to confrontation. Setting boundaries with a teenager or with a parent, leading a difficult mediation, asking for a raise, all the things that are difficult to do because you're not sure what the reaction is going to be. And then the third one is just an awkward conversation, comforting someone in times of tragedy, someone is unwell, you're not sure what to say, and so on and so forth. So those are the three conversations, and we're going to deal with all three. We also talked about the power of speech and how speech can be so powerful. It's the essence of the human experience. But the power of speech is its danger, because it's so powerful that if we do it wrong, it becomes, instead of being an amazing tool, it becomes something destructive. We gave the analogy of the horse and the rider. The horse is like the speech, which takes us places that we can't go on our own. But if we take a wrong turn, we go become lost very quickly, more than we can do on our own. So what we did last week, we said that there's three foundations of all conversations, just to remind you. The first is that we can't avoid the little conversations. Sometimes we just have to have them. Avoiding them just leads to explosion and leads to a rift in a relationship, and we need to have the conversations. The second is we need to ensure that it's a human conversation. And we talked about the difference between connecting to the world of the other person as opposed to animalistic conversation, which is sending signals from my world. And the third was that every conversation must be preceded by humility and thought. And we explained last week the formula of Yaakov, Jacob, and his two wives, Rachel and Leah. Leah being the world of thought, Rachel being the world of speech. Yaakov meaning ache of the heel, which is a symbol of humility. Every conversation, for it to be effective, needs to start, A, with humility, because we need to be ready to go out of our world and connect to the world of someone else, to put aside our own ego. Second, we need to give that thought and work out, and we'll talk a bit more about it today, of how that conversation is going to play out, and then we actually need to communicate. So that's the quick review from last week. Now today what I want to do is take these ideas and develop them into some general strategies. So what we're going to do is today we're going to talk about some strategies which are still general and good for all conversations, and then we're going to go for another 3 weeks, and in the next 3 weeks, each week we'll take a different category of conversations. And what I want to talk about today is a critical element of all conversations which comes at the back of the general foundations that we talked about last week. And that is the concept of timing, right? how we time a conversation. Conversations, all conversations. Communication is critical. Communication is the essence of the human experience. Communication is what creates the connection between us and other people. Communication nurtures and strengthens and enhances relationships. Communication can resolve conflict and can do wonderful, wonderful things. But we are called, human beings are called the midaber, the communicators, we talked about last week. But the effectiveness of the communication, firstly, will depend on the timing of when we have that conversation. Let me share with you a couple of things. First of all, we often quote from Pirkei Avot, which is the ethics of the fathers, the passages of the Mishnah that deal with social interactions and ethical behavior and so on. Let me share with you two passages from Pirkei Avot, two different paragraphs, which in Pirkei Avot, in the ethics of the fathers, are actually very close to each other. They actually are quite, they seem to be a little bit contradictory, but they're actually very close to each other, and we'll see that they're really two parts of the same equation. They're both about an element of conversation. The first one is in chapter 4, passage 15, which says, be the first to extend greetings to anyone that you meet. Right? It's a Mishnah, it's a passage that talks about the importance of greeting people. When we talk about greeting people, we're not just talking about saying the word hello in a cold, sort of detached way, but we're talking about greeting people warmly, making that initial introduction. Greeting people is considered, the Talmud talks about it, it's considered the connection, the first connection that happens between two people. You know, in Hebrew, there's a custom when you haven't seen someone for a long time, you say Shalom Aleichem. That's how we greet the angels on Friday night, but it's actually taken from that phrase. And the Talmud says that if someone greets someone or is the first one to greet someone with a warm Shalom Aleichem, it's a good omen for a long and healthy life. All of these things. Greeting someone is considered really, really important. To the point where the ethics of the fathers tells us that always be the first one. Make sure, like you see someone, jump in there. Be the first one to greet someone. And in fact, in another place of the Talmud, there was a great sage called Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Very, very great sage. And he said, he was particularly careful with this concept. And he explained and he emphasized that it's not only to do with people that we know well. It's to do with even people that we don't know. In fact, it's to do with people that we just happen to meet in the street. And we don't even know who they are. We never know how far a warm, smiling, good morning could do for someone. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said that he got this to a fine art. He actually excelled in this particular lesson. And he said that he said, no one ever greeted me first. Even a complete stranger or a non-Jew that I found in the marketplace, I was always the first to greet. This is what, at the end of his life, he said this. He says, this was one of my special mitzvot. I always make sure to jump in there and to be the first to greet. That's one mission. That's one passage. Then a couple of lines later, there's another passage. Passage 18. And it talks about times that we shouldn't talk. And it says two things. It says, do not placate your fellow being in the moment of his anger. And do not comfort a person while his dead lies before him. What does that mean? So, the one Mishnah, it's interesting, these two passages. The one passage is talking about when you should jump in and talk, greet. The other one is when you should hold back. But the truth is that they're both part of the very same concept. It's about timing a conversation. Timing a communication. The timing of when we talk is so important. Why? Because carrying on from what we talked about last week, the difference between human conversation and animal conversation. Let's just redefine it again. Animal conversation means I send a signal of what is happening in my world. Human conversation means I'm talking so that I can connect to your world. Now, when I connect, when I'm sending a signal, so then I just talk whenever I want. Because whenever the signal is on my mind, that's when it gets sent. Like an animal. If an animal is scared, they will transmit a signal that it is scared, it's hungry. An animal doesn't sit down to think, is this a good time to talk, not a good time to talk. It's a good time to have the conversation. Not a good time to have the conversation. The email doesn't do that. It just sends a signal. Us human beings do that also a lot of times. And sometimes it's good and sometimes it's terrible. Because sometimes the timing is really bad. Right? Because if the goal of communication, if the goal of conversation is not just to send a signal to my world, but the goal of the conversation is to connect to the world of the other, then it all depends on the context. So let's play this out. Let's talk about the first mission. The first mission says always be the first one to greet someone. Why? Because when you greet someone, it's a symbol of connection. When you greet someone warmly, you are demonstrating a willingness to connect. You're demonstrating a happiness to see the person. You're showing that you're eager, you're enthusiastic to connect, to make a connection. It might be with a total stranger. You might pass a stranger in the street, but greeting someone creates a connection between two human beings. I might never see the person again, but it doesn't matter. People connecting is a wonderful thing. Human beings connecting in a positive way is always a wonderful thing. It never goes astray. It never can be lost. It's never a waste. It might take a second. You don't know what you've done for that person. That's what the world is all about. Human beings are about connecting with each other, helping each other's world, supporting each other's world. And when you pass someone in the street that you don't know, but you give them a smile and you say, good morning with a smile, you never know what you've done. They might have had a really, really bad morning and on the way to work and you brighten their day. Or whatever. You can never know the effect of what we might have accomplished. There, to connect to the world of the other, means jump in and talk. Greet. Say hello. You might be preoccupied. You might not be in the mood, but make an effort because that's what the other person needs. That's what will enhance the connection between you and the other person. But when it comes to the example that the other missioner gives, which is when a person is in anger or a person is in shock from initial shock from a tremendous tragedy, the words the missioner uses is when his dead is before him. What that means is the initial stages of the shock. Right? There it's very different. It's very different because if you try and talk to someone when they're in a rage, and we'll talk about more details in a minute, we know it's not going to work. You will inflame the rage. That's what normally happens. It is not a good idea. Our natural instinct is to do that, right? And what they call it the dance of anger. Someone screams at you, so you have a reaction, you scream back, they scream louder, and you end up in a huge screaming match. It doesn't work. It doesn't diffuse the situation. There, when a person is in a fit of rage, normally the best thing is just to hold back. Doesn't mean you don't have to have a conversation. It's about the timing of the conversation. In fact, you will need to have a conversation. If someone blew up at you and exploded at you and is in a tremendous rage, that requires a conversation. It's not a conversation we can avoid. It needs resolution. It needs to be resolved. But not then. I want to talk. Yeah, that's my signal. I want to send a signal. But if I want to connect to the other person, I want to strengthen the relationship, I have to hold back. I have to wait for the timing. And we'll see why in a minute. Same thing with the second example. I think I mentioned this in previous times. You know, there's an amazing law. There's an amazing law, even when we are supposed to talk to people in tragedy. In the laws, you know that in the Shulchan Aruch, in the code of Jewish law, the laws of mourning and shiva and the whole process is very prescriptive and very, very detailed. And in fact, when one analyzes it for a separate discussion, it's an amazing process in grief expression and grief resolution and so on. But one of the laws is that when you go to a shiva house, not necessarily for a prayer, but you go during the week, during the thing, and your purpose is to come in and to comfort the mourner, which is a mitzvah. It's considered a great mitzvah to go into someone who has had a loss and to show them comfort and to comfort them. So when you go into a house of a mourner, it says that you shouldn't begin the conversation unless the mourner does. The mourner has to be the first one to begin the conversation. Why? It's an amazing law. But why are we coming? We're coming because we want to lift the spirits. We want to strengthen the person who's showing grief. We want to try and support them. We want to try and comfort them. Now, there's times that a person cannot be comforted. For example, as the Mishnah says, in the initial stages of tragedy, it's not a time to comfort. That's why the halacha is, the law is, that before the funeral, before the shiva actually starts, actually we don't have the mitzvah of comforting, because it's just best to be there but to hold back. Why? Sometimes we have this urge to say something. That's our signal. But if you want to do what's good for the person, want to do what's good for the relationship, what's good for the support, for the strengthening, for the conversation, for the world of the other, it's a time to hold back. But even during the 7 days of mourning, people go through stages. We should know from it, but those who have, God forbid, had to go through that experience will know that it's a roller coaster. It goes up and it goes down. One day you want to talk about the person that's passed away, one day you don't. You want to talk about the weather, you want to break. Right? So that's why the Shulchan Aruch says, even when you are supposed to have the conversation, wait for them to speak so you can gauge what the mood is. You can gauge what they want to talk about. You can understand what the atmosphere is like, so you know how to steer the conversation. Right? So the essence of the human being is communication. But the timing of that communication, if we want to have human communication, is so critical. Sometimes it's about jumping in, sometimes it's about holding back. And that's, yeah.
That's right. I know this is deviating from the topic, but maybe an opportune time. When you're in the chevra and the dead is before you.
Okay, it's a whole, I know what you're going to ask. It's a whole different discussion, but let's leave it for that. We'll maybe have a different time to
I
have a discussion.
It needs
but
to be addressed.
We won't start a series of that, actually, but we'll leave it for that. Yeah.
Okay.
Now, what I want to do is just maybe talk about the one part of the mission, not so much the person in mourning, but the other time of anger, like responding to anger, or responding to a tense situation. And we know this in all situations. For example, in parenting, it's the same way. The worst time to talk to a child about their bad behavior is when they're doing the bad behavior. Right? You ever, parents like a teenager or an older child gets really, really upset and they walk out the room and they slam the door. The parent says, "Come back here! Don't you dare slam the door in my place like that." That is such an ineffective way of communicating. You have no idea. I mean, we all do that and we all make mistakes like that, but it's like terrible. Because what do you think the kid is thinking? "Yes, you're right. I didn't think about it. You're actually right. I really need to reflect about my behavior. I need to improve my communication skills and my respect for parenting." The kid's in a fit of rage. Right? Worst time to talk about respect. The problem is that often we say nothing and then we don't deal with it later. That conversation is a critical conversation, but it needs to be had later. Right? It's a similar thing to what the Mishnah is telling us. Don't placate someone or don't speak to someone in the midst of the tension. You've got to hold back. You've got to know where to time the conversation. I'm going to just share with you on that passage that says don't placate someone when they're angry. I did a bit of research on that passage because the ethics of the fathers have a lot of commentary. And I just had a look. I was interested as I was preparing this to see what the various commentaries say about that particular passage. I'll just share with you what some of them actually say. One of the great commentaries called the Sephorna says that it's very similar. It's very simple. We know that when a person goes into a rage, that is one of the times that human beings don't have free choice. Right? Now, that's a surprising thing. I mean, we talk about the concept of free choice all the time. One of the unique things about the human being is that we have choices. We have choices about what to say and not to say. We have choices in our decisions. We have choices in our emotions. We have choices in lots of things. But we also know that, for example, when it comes to the concept of rage, if someone provokes you, the window of opportunity of free choice is actually very small. That's why we need to actually make that decision very quickly. Once we lose our temper while we are in a rage, have you ever lost your temper? That's an embarrassing question. That's an embarrassing question. Don't put up your hands. But if it happens to be that you've ever lost your temper, as I have, as other people have too, you would know that often you are screaming and ranting and raving, and in your mind, on some conscious intellectual level, you know that it's wrong, you know you're messing up, and you keep going. It's an amazing thing. Have you ever had that feeling? You know that you're being totally ineffective, you're probably being destructive, and you keep going. Why? Because the Sephorna explains that in a fit of rage, a person almost becomes like an animal. That's why rage is such a terrible thing. We actually lose our free choice. The free choice is before, the free choice is after. After we can choose to fix it up. While we're screaming and chanting and ranting and raving, we actually don't have a free choice. Says the Sephorna, so then what's the point of having a conversation then? How can you say to someone, no, please don't talk like that, or perhaps you're wrong, perhaps you're right, or try to placate them? They don't know what you're talking about. They're in a completely different reality. It's a bad time to have a conversation. One of the other commentaries points out an interesting thing. He says, we have a value in Judaism called zrizut. Zrizut means being quick. Very, very famous concept. Being quick means be quick to do a mitzvah. If a mitzvah comes your way, don't procrastinate. Get it done. If you have an opportunity to help someone, don't put it off for tomorrow because it won't happen. Just do it. There's a concept that some mitzvot, for example, we're able to do the entire day, but we have a look in the code of Jewish law and it says do it in the morning because it's always good to like pray in the morning, tefillin in the morning, lulav in the morning. You can do it all day if you haven't done it, but better to do it in the morning to show your enthusiasm, to show your alertness, to show your quickness. It's called zizut in Hebrew, to be able to do the right thing. But he says, zizut is a tremendous Jewish value, but not in conversation sometimes. Why? Because it all comes from the same source. It all comes from self-control. You see, normally the value of zrizut, the value of doing something quickly, is a self-control discipline issue. I get up in the morning, I have to do a good thing, something comes my way, there's an opportunity to do a mitzvah, I'm a little bit lazy, so I force myself and I get onto it and I have a bit of self-discipline and self-control and I jump in and I do it quickly. But that same self-control can happen the opposite way. Because when it comes to conversation, often instinct, our lack of self-control is result. In other words, our lack of self-control is doing it quickly. When it comes to conversation, hasty conversation normally in most cases is a lack of self-control, not an expression of self-control. It's not an expression of discipline because normally it just means it's an instinctive response. It's what's on my mind, what's on my heart, I just say it. Self-control means hold back. Over here, this result is not a value, it's the opposite. Take your time, process it, think about it, time it correctly, and then do it. Some of the commentaries point out that it's not only with regard to anger, it's with regard to any challenge. It's about thinking. And you know, the whole concept we said last week about Leah and Rachel. You know, often we talk about conversations. Someone challenges you about something. Someone asks you a question. You need to reflect what type of question is. You know, that sometimes people, I mean, I've had this as a rabbi, you have it often when people challenge you and ask questions, and there's different types of questions. Sometimes you have as a teacher also, your students do that sometimes too. You know, there's some kind of questions which are questions, genuine questions to seek an answer. And sometimes not a question. It's posed as a question, but just a challenge. And often, whatever you answer is just not going to be good enough. Often the answer is hold back. So it's about, again, the timing of the conversation, or even if they have the conversation now or ever maybe. Interesting, one of the great commentaries called the Tzlach. He points out an interesting thing. In that passage where it says don't placate someone when they're angry, it actually doesn't say that if you noticed. It said don't placate someone in the time of his anger. What does that mean? He says actually being sensitive to the other person's world and knowing how to time a conversation is deeper than just what's glaringly obvious. Sometimes a person is not losing their temper. But it's the time of anger. You can see the person is about to lose it. The person's on edge, they're agitated. You can see this is not a good time. This is like a person who has a sunburn that if you stroke it even gently, they're going to scream. Right? So, that concept of a conversation where I'm sensitive to the world of the other person means be sensitive to the nuances. Look at the body language. Look at the mood. Look at what they just said 2 minutes ago. They might not be screaming and shouting, but it just might not be the right time. Again, we shouldn't use that as an excuse not to have the conversation, because these conversations are important. But the timing is critical. And also, finally, there's a concept in the Talmud that, you know, in the time of the temple, if someone had transgressed, there would be a sacrifice to bring as an atonement. Like as an apology. But sometimes that sacrifice was preceded by another sacrifice called an olah, which is just a present. And the Talmud gives an analogy. He says, you know, sometimes you've got to know what to say in what order. You know, sometimes if you really hurt someone or if you've messed up and they're angry and they're upset and you go to them and you just say, look, I'm really sorry, like, you know, as if, like, out of the blue. And the guy says, my foot, you're sorry, kind of thing. Like, it is, you are sorry, but maybe you need to precede that. Maybe you need to talk about some other stuff first. You need to just settle the dust. You need to kind of create a bit of positive culture. Please. So it's about the order of what we say and when we say. Okay, now, I want to just shift to something else. But actually, before we do that, let me tell you a beautiful story about a conversation. One of my great heroes is a great Hasidic Rebbe called the Kloisenberger Rebbe. The Kloisenberger Rebbe was an amazing, amazing man. He was a great Hasidic Rebbe before the war, before the Shoah. He lost a wife and 10 children during the Shoah. Obviously, he was in the camps. And then afterwards, with an amazing resilience and determination, he rebuilt. And he married again and he had children. Today, his Hasidic dynasty called Sons is a tremendous community, both in America and in Israel. In Israel, it's in Natanya. They have a big community there. In fact, one of the things he promised during the war is that if he survives, he will build a hospital, which is, I forgot what it's called. I think it's called the Leonardo Hospital, I think, or something. In Natanya, it's a religious hospital.
Leonardo.
Sorry, what's that called?
Leonardo,
yeah. And it's a very advanced hospital. In fact, I'll just tell you another story with nothing to do with this, but a beautiful story. When they built the hospital, in the beginning, before he moved permanently to Israel, he went back and forth, Israel to America, because he actually built two communities, one in New Jersey, one in Natanya. And when they finally opened up the maternity ward in that hospital, he was in America. And when the first baby was born, he was in America at the time, and they called him up to tell him that the first baby had been born in the hospital, and they put the phone to the baby's crying so that he should hear the baby cry. And when he heard the baby cry, he said, "That's my revenge. Like, we rebuild." An amazing man. After the war, he spent a bit of time, as many people did, in a DP camp with a lot of survivors. And right away, immediately, as the whole Jewish community, he right away took upon himself a leadership role and started to inspire people and set up schools and try to get the resources for people to be able to do, you know, to daven and to learn and to get together and marriages and so on and so forth. One day, someone came to see him and said, "We've got a problem with a teenager. There's a teenager who's very, very angry, as you can imagine, as many people were. And he's lost a tremendous amount of his family. And he came from a very religious and pious family, and he's angry, he's not interested, he just won't talk, he's not responsive, he won't do anything, he says he doesn't believe in anything. And we want to try and support him, we want to try and do something." So the Kloisenberger Rebbe said, "If you can convince him to come and see me, that would be great." So they tried to ask this kid if he would go, and he said, "What am I going to go to this rabbi? He's going to start convincing me, he start explaining to me, I'm not interested in anything, I'm just not doing it." Eventually, however, they somehow persuaded him to come into to the room where the Kloisenberger Rebbe was, and he was sitting by a table, and the guy plunked himself down and said nothing. So the Rebbe just waited. He waited and waited and waited, again, timing of the conversation. And eventually, this boy was actually waiting for the Rebbe to start talking, and he thought he's going to, you know, start lecturing me and start explaining to me, and he just wasn't interested, but he kind of was persuaded or pushed to go and see him, so he was sitting there. The Rebbe's saying nothing, absolutely nothing. So eventually the kid blurts out and he says, "They took the best," referring to his family, of course, that had been killed. So the Kloisenberger Rebbe looked at him. It's a beautiful story. He looked at him, he took his hand, and just repeated what he said. He said, "They took the best." And started to cry. And as he started to cry, the boy started to cry. They held each other's hand and they just both cried for 20 minutes. And that was the end of the conversation. And the boy left and he came back and he rejoined the community and he was on the road to a real strong recovery. How to have a conversation, how to time a conversation, and what to say when is so important. I mean, that's in a time of tremendous tragedy. But it applies to any conversation. It's that timing of how we choose what is going to be effective, what is going to help the other person, what is going to enter the world of the other person. So often we have conversations because we say what is on our mind without enough consideration of what is going to work for the other person. Now, let's take that a little bit further, because what I've said till now really is about timing a conversation so it's good for the other person, for the listener, for the person who I want to talk to. But the truth is that it's not just for the person I want to talk to. Sometimes waiting or delaying a conversation is as important, just not for the person I'm talking to, but it's important for me as well, for the person who's talking. Sometimes conversations are just impossible to have without processing first, without giving it enough thought, without holding back first. Sometimes there are certain conversations that if we have them too soon, even if the person we're talking to is ready, but if we have them too soon, it's going to be a disaster. Why? You know, the Talmud tells us a fascinating thing. That after the Jews sinned with the golden calf, so Moses, who was the ambassador of the Jewish people, the advocate on behalf of the Jewish people, this was considered a major sin in the time of the Chumash. And Moses went to appease God, so to speak. He wanted to ask God for forgiveness for what the Jewish people had done. And God said to Moses, wait until my anger passes, and then you can appease me. So paraphrasing the verse, that's what it says. Now, with God and Moses, in that conversation, we have an interesting concept. It's not like a human being. God has choice all the time. God, when we say God is angry, it doesn't mean God went into a fit of rage. God is above all of that. So Moses had to wait to have the conversation, and obviously it wasn't because God needed the break. It's not like when I talk to someone who's in a fit of anger, I need to wait because it's not good for them. I'm not going to do anything for them. God is ready for the conversation anytime. But from here we learn an amazing thing, that sometimes we need to wait for us. We need time. Because certain conversations need time to think it through so that it will be done correctly. And that's what God is telling Moses. He says, you're not ready for the conversation. You need to wait. You wait until my anger has passed, and then you can have the conversation for your benefit. Why is this? Because let's go back to the formula we talked about last week, which is the formula of all conversations, Yaakov, Leah, and Rachel. Right? Yaakov means humility, Leah means thought, and Rachel means communication. That's what we explained last week. Often when we have conversations, just to get to the point where the conversation is based on humility, which means I'm ready to put my world aside for a minute and to see what's good for the other, just to have that humility to do that takes time. Why? Because rushed conversations are normally an expression of my emotions, which means it's normally expressions of my ego. There's a book called Getting Past No by William, I don't know how to pronounce it, U-R-Y. Getting Past No, it's a very good book. And he says, if you're in a situation of confrontation, someone has provoked you, someone has said something to you, someone has done something that requires a conversation, but it's a tense conversation, he says, the first thing you need to do is what he calls, go to the balcony. He doesn't mean go to the physical balcony. He says, go to the virtual balcony, the symbolic balcony. Why? Because quick responses come directly from the heart. Now, some things that come from the heart are good. But in conversation, a conversation that comes purely from a heart means it comes from my emotion, it comes from my feeling, and it means it comes from my ego. It's what I want to say. And it's very hard to control that. It is almost impossible for the normal human being, when provoked or in a tense situation, to respond quickly, and it should be done properly, thought out, coming from humility. It's almost impossible. Because most people, we have natural instincts, and natural instincts are expressed in quick responses. You know, today in many, many companies, they now have a rule. If someone sends you an email, you have to wait 24 hours before you respond to the email. Right? Because you know how much damage is done in corporations and in companies by quick responses. Especially in email. You know, part of the problem with email and WhatsApp and messaging and all these things today is that we hide behind them. And we're, by the way, it's a good time to mention this. When we're talking about having a good conversation and an important conversation and not avoiding a conversation, it also means not hiding behind an email or not hiding behind a message. Right? So many times people... I mean, messages are fantastic things. If you're trying to, you know, track someone down that's not available and you need to get a message very quickly, that's what it's for. Or you want to share cute things or cute concepts through WhatsApp or groups and things like that, it's great. But so often today what it's used for is, I'm afraid to say that to someone, so I'll text them or email them instead. That's not a conversation, that's hiding behind technology. We can't do that. Yeah.
What's the book called?
Getting Past No. It's the same author, by the way, once we're on this, who talked about a book, he wrote a book called Getting to Yes. So it's negotiating skills. He has two books, Getting to Yes and Getting Past No.
And so his name again?
William, yep. U-R-Y. I don't know how to pronounce it, I'm sorry. So therefore, in order to ensure that a conversation is not a direct transmission of our own instincts and our own emotions, we need time to process. Everyone needs time to process. We need time just to process that Yaakov. Because what happens is, When a raw nerve gets touched, that is the main time where our ego becomes expressed. You know, sometimes we can manage our ego, but when an instinctive conversation is when we don't manage it well. When someone says something that pushes a button, that's when the ego comes to the forefront. In order to have a Yaakov conversation, to make sure that the conversation is based on humility, we just simply need time to process. Otherwise, the conversation will come from arrogance, the action will bring a reaction, our reaction will bring another reaction, and will very quickly derail into what we said before. It's called the dance of anger. Okay? What do we do in that time when we go to the balcony? So he explains a couple of interesting things. He says, first of all, we need time to think, hold on a second, what's the goal? We just need to go to our symbolic, emotional balcony and think about, before I respond, I know I need to respond, but what's the goal of the conversation? A very simple thing. If you're not sure, take a pen and a paper. I know I need to say something, what is the goal? Is the goal to get it off my chest? Not a good idea. It might be part of the goal and needs to be done, even sometimes it is a goal. Sometimes you need to share with someone, you need to say to someone, look, I'm just struggling with this, I need to share with you something that you did to me or you said to me, but that's got to be done. If that's the goal, that's fine, but then you need to think about how to do that. Very often that's not the goal. Very often the goal of the conversation is because you're in conflict and there's a certain result that you want to try and achieve. Well, instinctive conversation is just not going to achieve the result. So in situations of tense conversations, where you know you have to have a conversation or you're upset about something and emotions are flying high, go to the balcony. Step one, on the balcony, write down and establish, before I go back into the house and have the conversation, what is the goal? What am I trying to achieve? And therefore my conversation will be based on the most effective way in achieving that goal. The second thing we need to do in that balcony is a process that it's not about being right. This is such a hard thing for human beings to do. Often in conversations we want to be right. And most times being right doesn't achieve anything. It doesn't make a stronger connection. It doesn't enhance a relationship. It's not about being right. It's about achieving a goal. The goal might be achieving something that I want. It might be a negotiation. The goal might be achieving a stronger relationship. The goal might be terminating a relationship. Whatever the goal is, but the conversation has to be led and has to be based on the goal and not about being right. That's the humility. As human beings, we have this crazy instinctive need to be right. Almost an obsession with, I can't not be right because how am I going to be looked at? It's going to be seen as a weakness. Where the opposite is true. If we're prepared to give up our own ego and lead a conversation when we're not always right, but we're achieving results, mutual benefit, that's the ultimate strength. And yet us as human beings, because we're fragile and insecure sometimes, we feel that it's a weakness to be wrong or not to be completely right. And therefore part of the time that we need often to back off is not just for the other person, it's for us to go and process. And just to think about, it's not about being right. It's about achieving a goal. What is the goal? And therefore, I need to achieve the goal. And even if achieving the goal means that I need to say things in conversation that don't make me right and doesn't persuade the other person that I was right, that's a strength. I need to be able to do that. I need to have enough humility, which is ultimately a strength, to be able to actually do that. So much so that we find, we've talked about this previously, that we know one of the greatest things in conversation is saying the truth. And yet the Talmud tells us, and we learn this from the Chumash itself, from the stories of the Chumash, that it's okay to change the truth if the goal is to achieve peace, right? Often that's abused sometimes, because sometimes what people do is they use that line, but it's actually not to achieve peace, it's to achieve their own comfort. But it's about achieving, if it's going to be good for the peace, if it's going to be good for the relationship, we're allowed to change the truth under certain circumstances.
What does that mean,
change the truth? We're allowed to lie. Yeah. I was trying to say nicely. Lies are bad words. I was going to, you know, we're allowed to modify the truth. Put it that way, right? If not for our protection, but for the better of the relationship, or sometimes, and this is, you know, goes right in. There's a beautiful, beautiful Yiddish expression. I'll say it in Yiddish and I'll translate it. Yeah. You know, sometimes we don't even have to lie. It's not about being lying, but it's about not if you're not obsessed about being right, there's a beautiful Yiddish expression that says, "Metarnish zogen aligno, medafnish zogen the ganze emes," which means you're not allowed to say a lie, but you don't always have to say the whole truth, right? You don't have to go into detail of how the other person messed up. You don't have to say anything sometimes. Just like back off. Sometimes, you know, we want to say the truth, and there are people that are born with this nature of being truthful. It's an amazing personality, and it's got an amazing disadvantage. People who stand for truth, obviously, you know, what do you mean? He's got to hear the truth. It's, I don't want to lie, I want to be honest, and all this kind of thing. That's about being right. Often the conversation doesn't need to go that way. It's not effective. What we're trying to pursue is the effectiveness of the relationship. Entering the other person's world, being humble enough to put myself aside. It's not about being right. It's about, I don't mean to be a politician and to be fake, but it's not about saying things that will hurt the other person. It's about steering the conversation in ways where we know it's going to be effective and it's going to resolve and diffuse and be better for achieving the goal. Sometimes, as he explains in the book, when we're talking about a negotiation, it's about identifying what they call in negotiation literature a BATNA. B-A-T-N-A. BATNA means the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. Which means, in simple language, that we need time, we need to go to that balcony, because part of having a conversation is testing it. Like, what happens if this conversation doesn't succeed? What happens if the person doesn't accept my apology? What happens if the person doesn't want to go down the same direction that I want it? What happens if we have a dispute and we cannot resolve it? What am I going to do then? What's my alternative? What's the best alternative? Am I going to push it? Am I willing to do it alone? Am I willing to go somewhere else? If you can't work it out with your boss, are you willing to look for another job? Right? It's about understanding what are the alternatives. What's going to happen if it doesn't go the way I think it's going to go? Because not every conversation is necessarily going to go the way I want. All these things we need in that balcony break. We need to think. Why? Because as we said before, it's a beautiful formula. Yaakov Lea Rachel. First of all, we need to be ready to be humble and take time to reveal that humility and put aside the ego, put aside the instincts, put aside the aggression, put aside the emotion. We have to think through a conversation and then have it. Without the thinking of the conversation, these things are not going to come automatically. With 99.9% of human beings, no one has the natural skill to have these type of conversations quickly. We need to give it time. The timing of a conversation for the person who we're talking to and us who's speaking and communicating is crucial. I saw a beautiful little story. You know, because sometimes it's just about also shifting. It's about just shifting our whole perspective. Part of the problem, and we've talked about this so many times, is we get locked into the way we think and we just can't see a way out. Part of the break is withdrawing, is to think about creative ways of looking at something. So I saw a little story about a man who passed away and left 17 camels to his three sons. And he left in his will the following instruction: that half the camel should go to his eldest son, a third to his middle son, and a ninth to his youngest. So they were respectful children, they didn't want to fight about this, so we're sitting down and it's just not possible. The math doesn't add up. You can't do that unless you cut up one of the camels. And they thought like this and like that, and they thought and thought and talked and talked, and there's just no way to do it. So finally, the sons decided they're going to go consult in the town an old wise woman. They went to ask her, and the woman said, "Okay, what happens if you take my camel? Add it to the equation." Okay. So now they had 18 camels. So the eldest son took half, which is 9. That middle son took a third, which is 6, right? The other son took a ninth, which is 2. 2 out of 18. How much is 9, 6, and 2? 17. And then they gave the camel back to the woman. Now, I don't know if it's a true story or not, and I don't know if that was the correct... It would be interesting if that came before a halachic tribunal or a secular court. I'm not sure if that would be the answer, but it's an amazing little cute story, because what it teaches us is, and maybe if it's a true story, maybe that was the intention of the father. Like, don't get stuck. Think of other ways to look at a situation. There are so many ways to look at one situation. There's so many ways to look at a conversation. There are so many ways to resolve a problem. And if we can't do it ourselves, we have to ask someone else. We have to go ask the old wise woman of the town, right? And that also takes a strength. because sometimes we're just not able to do things ourselves and we want to do it ourselves, and yet it doesn't work. We need a fresh perspective. Also, it's about time. So just in summary, let's just revise some of the thoughts. We talked about this concept about making sure it's human conversation, not animal conversation. In order to do that, timing of the conversation is important. Important for the speaker, important for the listener. Certain conversations, we jump in and we have them like greeting someone. Certain conversation, when we're comforting someone, it's not the time to talk. It's time just to be there. If it's confrontation, tension, anger, we both need a break. I need to make sure I'm not addressing someone when they're angry because they're not talking. I'm not going to enter their world. But as we said now, it's not just about them, it's about us. We need time. We need time to be able to process, to think, to reveal the Yaakov, the humility, and to give a lot of thought to what we want to do and how we want to achieve the goal and enter the world of the other person and strengthen the relationship rather than just express what I'm feeling and destroy the whole thing. Now, as I say, the next 3 weeks, I'm finishing a few minutes early for a reason which I'm going to share with you in a moment, but in the next 3 weeks, we're going to take each week a different type of conversation and try to have a look at specific strategies in order to deal with it. Now, I'm going to ask you just for your attention for 2-3 minutes. I'm going to ask Mrs. Letterman to come in here for a second, because I'm going to get into major trouble for this, by the way, but we're going to do it anyway. So, today is Nachama Letterman's Hebrew very special birthday. I won't say which one it is. You'll work it out yourself. I just want to say, it's not just that it's a special birthday. Please come in. A number of years ago, besides being a very, very close family friend, but a number of years ago when we started Bina, what was then known as Chinuch Foundation, and we had the Shtibel up there, it went through its different phases, we started very, very small, and I called up Ms. Letterman and I said, I just need help for 3 hours a week. I think I can manage 3 hours a week. Well, it never was 3 hours a week. In fact, it never even began as 3 hours a week. But ever since then, she's been an integral part of Vina and the whole organization with tremendous dedication, with tremendous thing. And it's a good time. It's a good time on behalf of all of us to express our thank you and to wish you a very, very big Mazel Tov and a very special birthday. While we're talking about that, also big Mazel Tov. Ms. Levin just had a new grandson over in Toronto. You should be blessed with lange gesunte yaren, with a lot of nachas and simcha and bracha. So in honor of the birthday, and while we're talking about birthdays, I should also mention that today is also Elna's Hebrew birthday. So a big, big mazel tov to Elna as well. So we'd like to, first of all, give you a little gift on behalf of the whole Bina team. And we ask everyone to please join in some cake. Happy birthday cake. Ms. Letterman, we need you to cut the cake.